People with disabilities have often been forgotten in politics, but after the 2020 election, they're hopeful for change.
One of the most exciting things about the 2020 Democratic primary is that we saw campaigns compete with each other in order to put forward ambitious proposals on how to expand home and community-based services.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Monday, November 16th, how this election may change the way we look at disenfranchised communities. Plus, Native Americans played a big role in electing Joe Biden, and until now, they've received little recognition for their contributions to politics as a whole.
And there's just the feeling that we're not relevant in some ways.
And COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations are continuing to rise across the country, but there seem to be no coordinated approach to curbing it. That's where we start today. As thousands of Americans continue to die from the coronavirus, President Trump's obsession with the election has resulted in a void in leadership from the White House. The result has been a patchwork of uneven responses from state and local officials around the country, often driven by politics. So far, Democratic governors in states like New Mexico, Oregon, and Washington have announced orders that will dramatically roll back business activity in their states.
Every part of our state will see rollbacks in some sense.
If we want to give Oregonians a fighting chance, we must take further measures to flatten the curve now. That's why I'm announcing a two-week freeze.
We are doing a reset or pausing for 2 weeks. It means that all New Mexicans are instructed to shelter in place.
This is not forever. This is only for now.
On Friday night, Republican Governor Doug Burgum of North Dakota announced a new set of policies for his state, including a statewide mask mandate, a measure Burgum himself had opposed for months.
Our situation has changed, and we must change with it to protect our most vulnerable and to ensure hospital capacity. To be clear, these are statewide requirements, not simply recommendations.
But many Republican governors remain reluctant to force businesses to close back down or implement statewide mask mandates. Here's Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt at a press briefing last week.
As far as a mandate, I've been very clear that I don't think that's the right thing to do. This is a personal responsibility. This is pleading with people to do the right thing.
In many places, pleading doesn't seem to be doing enough to stem the tide of the virus. For the past week, an average of more than 1,000 people have died each day from the coronavirus. So there's a lot of mixed messaging from our public officials at a dire moment for public health in this country. But trying to make sense of leadership in this moment is where we start today. Joining me now is Dan Goldberg, healthcare reporter at Politico and author of The Golden 13, How Black Men Won the Right to Wear Navy Gold. Welcome back to the show, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dan, let's talk. I mean, we just heard at the very top of the show here the differences in how some Democratic lawmakers are approaching the coronavirus pandemic compared to some Republicans. What are some of the biggest differences you're seeing in how these states are responding?
The biggest difference is a philosophical one. Democratic governors, by and large, throughout this pandemic, have been much more hands-on, much more quick to use public health authorities from a state level to tamp down on businesses, to impose restrictions on gathering, to require masks. Republicans have, I'm painting with somewhat of a broad brush, this isn't true for all the governors, but most Republican governors have relied on individual responsibility, have pleaded with their constituents to do the right thing, and have been very wary of using the power of government to restrain economic activity or to punish people who aren't wearing masks.
You know, we've talked a lot about how President-elect Joe Biden, I should say, has a COVID task force. He has the people in position. He has grand plans. And one of those grand plans is to implement a mask mandate. Dan, you've spoken to governors across the states, across the country. What did they tell you about their openness to a federal mask mandate?
Well, of the dozen or so states that don't have one at the moment, you know, there are a bunch of Republican governors who, as of last week, had not yet even accepted that Joe Biden had won the election. So that's a bad start if you're the incoming administration. For many others, you know, you just played that clip from Governor Stitt in Oklahoma, Governor Ricketts in Nebraska, Governor Reynolds in Iowa, certainly Governor Noem in South Dakota. They have all said that they would not be receptive to a call from Joe Biden. And it's worth remembering that, you know, while while President Trump has mocked mask use and downplayed the seriousness of the virus, his administration, including Deborah Birx, Anthony Fauci, CDC Director Robert Redfield, Jerome Adams, the Surgeon General, they have traveled the country begging governors to impose mask mandates. They have pleaded for people to wear masks, to be socially distant, and those calls have gone unanswered. So it was always a bit of a stretch to imagine that a phone call from Joe Biden would change their mind. It's worth remembering, like I said in the beginning, that some of these governors are philosophically opposed to this just on political grounds. But also from a political point of view, while Donald Trump may be leaving the White House, Trumpism remains a potent force, especially in some of these states. You have to remember that, you know, Donald Trump won these states by 30, 40 points. He has a lot of force and power there. So to cross him, even the appearance of crossing him, can be tantamount to political suicide for some of these governors.
And, you know, we should be clear also that there are, I mean, we are here in New York. The show is broadcast out of New York. I live in New York. And even among, you know, this is a Democratic state. It's a blue state. It's got Governor Andrew Cuomo and Mayor Bill de Blasio are often at odds themselves about how to manage the coronavirus limitations. You know, even up until yesterday, on Sunday, parents were on edge trying to decide whether or not their children were going to go to school or not going to go to school. So, you know, it's not so much just Republican lawmakers. I think we're also seeing some skirmishes among Democratic lawmakers, at least here in New York, in terms of how to even approach this.
Not just in New York, across the country, you're seeing that. And I should be clear, I don't envy any governor who has to make the decision of whether to effectively cancel someone's livelihood. You know, I just saw just before we started talking, the New Jersey governor implemented new restrictions, capping gatherings at 10 people down from 25 and capping outdoor gatherings at 150 people down from 500. You know, these are going to have life and death consequences for some businesses. And
now, but let's talk about that, Dan, because I'm mm-hmm. sitting here and I'm saying, okay, some people, including myself, have been in pretty serious isolation for about 9 months now. But, you know, we're hearing different directives even from health officials who say, you know, no indoor gatherings with people who aren't wearing masks. And then we hear some people say, even here in New York, and as you mentioned, New Jersey, it's okay to have up to 10 people at an indoor gathering. And then other people say you shouldn't even have Thanksgiving. So the messages are confusing, depending. I mean, it almost feels like no one's really in charge here.
Yes, there's certainly a leadership vacuum that probably starts at the federal government, but it winds its way down to the different states and even cities. I mean, like you said, you broadcast out of New York. For how many months have we seen the mayor and governor of New York be on different pages when it comes to coronavirus restrictions? I think Tony Fauci has probably said it best in that every activity you do, you have to be thinking about managing risk. So the risk of going into a crowded indoor place is obviously very high. If it's not a crowded indoor place, but it's still indoors, well, it's less risk, but that doesn't mean it's no risk. And unfortunately, I think many Americans across the country have had trouble sort of parsing that out. It's a very gray area. Well, how much risk is acceptable risk? I really want to see my grandparents or my daughter or, you know, have my kid's birthday, but it's risky. But how risky? These are not easy answers. And I think all that gray area is one reason why people have sort of thrown up their hands across the country and said, you know what, I'm just going to take my chances. Unfortunately, that has led to a spike in infections that has overrun healthcare systems across the country.
And let's talk about what some of those stricter, should I say, limitations are being put into place around the country. Dan, where are you seeing some pretty strict enforcement right now? I believe Chicago is one of the cities that's also starting to implement some version of a stay-at-home order.
Yes, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot just implemented a stay-at-home order. And that was followed by near lockdown orders in New Mexico and Oregon and Washington State. I think we just saw new restrictions in North Dakota and Nebraska. That's notable because, and Utah, three very conservative states have put in new restrictions. For example, in Oregon, they're limiting restaurants and bars to takeout only. So these are pretty serious restrictions. But just to give you, you know, a sense of where we are, you know, you played the clip from New Mexico earlier. You know, New Mexico at the beginning of October had about 80 patients in its hospitals with COVID. Now it's close to 500 in 6 weeks. So these are states that are really struggling to get a handle on the virus. And I know a lot of politicians have used the metaphor of a dimmer switch, that they have tried not to turn on or off the economy, but sort of to dim the lights when possible. Many of these governors have found that they've dimmed as much as they can, and it's time to go back to, you know, to extend the metaphor, turning the lights off. And I think that's what you're seeing now in a lot of the southwestern states and plain states.
Now, is the concern here political viability? I mean, as we mentioned, the president, President Trump, is still the president for the next, at least until the January 20th, and these governors might be wary of incurring his wrath. But at what expense? I mean, 1,000 Americans a day passed away from this virus last week.
Correct. And I think it's not just President Trump's wrath. They have to worry about their own constituents. I mean, don't forget, it was only a few weeks ago that the governor of Michigan was the target of a plot to kidnap her. The governor, we heard reports that the governor of Virginia and Iowa were also targeted. You know, and that's just the fringe, most extreme elements of society. But there are real political consequences to shutting down your economy. And then on top of that, you have to worry about how, once you do shut it down, how do you recover? What are the long-term effects of, you know, putting people out of work, reducing your tax base? You know, I know in Washington, the governor is making available $50 million to sort of help people get through the next few weeks who've lost their business. But that money's going to go pretty quickly, and it's going to leave you with a spate of horrible choices to make in January.
And the federal government, Dan, we should be clear, has not announced any additional stimulus funding for small businesses or other businesses who are affected by the pandemic. Isn't that right?
That's correct. The Democratic House and the Republican Senate have been at odds with each other for months. And even though the president, President Trump, has tweeted repeatedly that he wants to see a big, beautiful coronavirus relief deal, there isn't much movement at the moment on Capitol Hill. And as last we checked, the two sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, are hundreds of billions of dollars apart. So while I never want to say never, it does not look likely that we are going to see a new relief package before the end of this calendar year.
Dan, the Trump administration hasn't allowed President-elect Biden to even start coordinating with federal agencies, including meeting with Dr. Anthony Fauci and others. What should they be doing right now, and how much of an effect is that going to have on the Biden administration's ability to really start this plan from day one?
You know, Tony Fauci had a great metaphor. He said this is sort of like a relay race. You want to pass the baton while still running in full speed. And essentially what the Trump administration is making the Biden team do is stop, grab the baton, and start running again. They have not, they just don't know everything that the Trump administration knows. They haven't been able to coordinate with HHS, with the CDC. So they are relying on what they can glean from talking to the private companies that are involved with the federal government, but it's not the same thing. So that's just going to, you know, every day, like you mentioned, is 1,000 American deaths. So every day's delay means another 1,000 people might die. And when you talk about just the huge, massive workings of the federal government, it is not easy to take control of the ship of state. And so these delays, these inability to know what's going on inside the agencies that you're about to lead, are incredibly costly.
Now, we know that we're not the only country that's grappling with another surge in coronavirus cases. We're seeing in Europe, for example, there are lockdowns there beginning to happen in some form. How would you compare how we're responding to this as opposed to other countries, Dan?
You know, we are about 2 to 3 weeks, if you look at the epidemiological curve, we're about 2 to 3 weeks behind some of Southern Europe, which is getting hit pretty hard. But that doesn't mean we won't get there. And what had to happen in Europe was real lockdowns of the entire country. Now, they can have an easier time of it, sometimes because they're smaller countries and sometimes just because of the political culture in those countries. But they are so overwhelmed and overrun that they've had to really go to lockdown 2.0, which is something that obviously they had hoped to avoid. But it's worth pointing out, like you said, this is not unique to the United States. How we respond has been so far pretty unique. We have, more so than any large country, debated whether coronavirus was even worth taking seriously.
We'll be checking in with you as this story evolves. Dan Goldberg is a healthcare reporter at Politico. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
About 1 in 5 eligible U.S. voters has a disability. But unlike other major voting blocs, the disability community still doesn't get a lot of attention when it comes to elections. That changed a little bit last week when President-elect Joe Biden acknowledged the disability community in his victory speech.
We must make the promise of the country real for everybody, no matter their race, their ethnicity, their faith, their identity, or their disability.
Disability rights activists and allies praised the moment on social media, and for many, it was long overdue in our national politics. Meanwhile, voters with disabilities continue to face obstacles at the ballot box. Expanded mail-in voting because of COVID-19 made it easier for some people with disabilities to vote this year, but that's not been the case for everyone. In other states, inaccessible polling sites, broken machines, or the absence of curbside voting further complicated the electoral process. For more on this, I'm joined by Ari Ne'eman, Senior Research Associate at the Harvard Law School Project on Disability. Ari, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So let's define the community that we're talking about. When we talk about people with disabilities, who are we talking about?
So the Americans with Disabilities Act was written to define disability very broadly. So disability rights protections include people who use wheelchairs, people with Down syndrome, and other things that are commonly thought of as disabilities, but they also extend to a wide variety of chronic conditions like diabetes, COPD, and many of the conditions that increase vulnerability to COVID-19. So, you know, in fact, disability rights legal protections are more important than ever and have been very important tools for people with disabilities who are concerned about how the pandemic may be impacting their ability to engage with the broader world.
Do we have a sense of how large this voting bloc is in the United States?
So, like other communities, people with disabilities and their families don't necessarily vote in unison. However, approximately 1 in 5 Americans has a disability of some kind.
And what, if any, can you tell us about the turnout this year, which, of course, for 2020 was a unique year for so many voters, just in terms of accessibility, in terms of the pandemic restrictions. But for people with disabilities, do we know what their turnout numbers were like this year?
So one of the unfortunate realities of the disability community being ignored in national politics for so long is that the disability vote isn't included in most polling or exit polling. So we actually have a pretty clear idea of what the disability vote was like in 2018, where it surged by 8.5 points relative to the 2014 midterm elections. But we don't necessarily have hard numbers regarding the disability vote in 2020 yet. We'll likely have that in a few months when census data comes out. Now, you know, I think anecdotally, the information suggests that COVID has impacted disability turnout in some very interesting ways. In states that opted for greater use of mail-in voting. People with disabilities may have had an easier time voting than they may have had in the past when mail-in voting was more restricted. In states that made mail-in voting and curbside voting more difficult, people with disabilities may have had, and almost certainly did have, a harder time voting, as you had to risk your life in order to enter an in-person polling place. And that really represents a significant barrier to exercising the franchise. This is something that's played out in particular in states that have restricted the use of accommodations to people who can prove a disability. In Texas, for example, mail-in voting was only made available if you could show that you have a disability. And one of the things we've seen is that when those kinds of bureaucratic requirements are put in place, lots of people who would be eligible for mail-in voting and eligible for other kinds of accommodations just don't know how to navigate the process, or may not even know that having a chronic health condition like diabetes or many others qualifies them for disability accommodations.
Ari, are there, I mean, granted, many voting blocks are not monoliths, and I imagine that people with disabilities, that holds true for people with disabilities, but are there common areas that motivate this group to get to the polls?
One of the top priorities is expanding home and community-based services, supports that keep people with disabilities in their own homes rather than forcing people into institutions or nursing homes in order to get help. We've seen during COVID-19 that nursing home placement can be a death sentence for many people with disabilities. And even before COVID, people simply didn't want to give up their freedom in order to access support. One of the most exciting things about the 2020 Democratic primary is that we saw campaigns compete with each other in order to put forward ambitious proposals on how to expand home and community-based services. A lot of folks are very excited to see how Joe Biden, the president-elect, will work to fulfill some of those promises.
Disability issues, from what we understand, have historically been bipartisan. Has that changed in this current iteration of Washington, where pretty much everything is a partisan issue?
We're beginning to see partisan polarization around disability as well. And it's very concerning, in large part because that wasn't always the case. If you look back to the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, that was signed into law under George H.W. Bush's administration. It had a number of prominent Republican champions like Lowell Weicker and Bob Dole. And we've just seen a real shift in the Republican Party to the extent to which, you know, any proposals for expanded resources, expanded civil rights protections are met with intense resistance. In part because of that, there's growing conversation about how we can make disability rights part of the larger progressive coalition, which is something of an unusual space for a community that's historically thought of itself as a bipartisan issue. But in a lot of ways, it's just a natural outgrowth of the radicalization of the Republican Party.
I recall earlier on in the Trump administration, President Trump mocked a reporter, a New York Times reporter, who has a disability. And I should be transparent in that I know that reporter, and I've worked with them at the New York Times. But what tone did that set in terms of the way the Republican Party views people with disabilities?
Certainly, folks were not happy about President Trump mocking Serge Kovalevsky. But I think folks were even less happy about the Trump administration proposing to cut hundreds of billions of dollars in Medicaid funding, or the administration rescinding Department of Justice guidance on integrating people with disabilities into the workforce, or countless other areas where the Trump administration has rolled back Obama-era protections around disability rights. The disability rights community is a very policy-oriented community. It's interesting. I would say that if you talk to most disability activists, they're going to point to the various ways in which the Trump administration has attacked disability rights legal protections and sought to slash disability service funding rather than very high profile incident of the president mocking Serge Kovalevsky. When we talk about the harms the Trump administration has caused in terms of disability politics, folks tend to be very brass tacks, and there's just such a strong body of evidence showing that the Trump administration has made things worse for disability services, for the programs that people with disabilities depend on.
We've been seeing a lot of attention, at least pre-pandemic, paid to representation of people with disabilities, for example, in advertising campaigns and in media, for example. You know, do we need more representation of people with disabilities, congressional members with disabilities, in order to move these issues forward and perhaps avoid the lack of bipartisanship that we're seeing today?
I think we do. There's a concept called the hidden army. The hidden army is the wide number of people with disabilities and family members of people with disabilities in positions of influence in Congress, the executive branch, and even the media. And that's been a huge asset for the disability rights movement. Certainly, we do want to see more disabled elected officials. And there's been growing interest in that. Groups like the National Council for Independent Living and the American Association of People with Disabilities have been working to encourage greater opportunities for disabled people to run for office and to help build more infrastructure for turning out the disability vote. So I would say that the disability community represents a potential sleeping giant in American politics. You know, if you look at some of the places where disability activists have been engaged on social media, in particular the influential Crip the Vote hashtag started by Alice Wong and a number of other disability activists, candidates really went to where the community was. You saw a number of top-tier candidates in the primary do hashtag conversations with Crip the Vote, issue comprehensive disability policy proposals, really engaging with the grassroots of the disability community. I think campaigns realize that this is an area that really drives voting behavior to a significant extent because it is so near and dear to people's lives.
Ari Nehman is a senior research associate at the Harvard Law School Project on Disability. Ari, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Vote tallies show that Joe Biden is the winner in Georgia, a state that hasn't turned blue since 1992. But the state has also begun the labor-intensive process of recounting all of the ballots in 2020 by hand. Georgia has until November 18th to finish counting all of the ballots. Tia Mitchell is a Washington correspondent with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and she's with us to explain all of this. Tia, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me again.
Why are we doing a hand recount in Georgia?
Well, the easy answer is because the Secretary of State decided that was the most transparent way to audit the election and ensure to anyone, any naysayers, that it was accurate. And so he, even though it didn't require it, he called for a full hand count of the presidential election.
So, Tia, we know this is a very labor-intensive process. Will all the counties be done with the count by November 18th?
Well, the recount has to end by midnight on Wednesday. And then, of course, the November 20th deadline for certification. But it's looking like it's going well, actually. A lot of the biggest counties in Georgia are done already. They finished over the weekend. Some of the other counties in Metro Atlanta say they'll be done by Monday, the end of Monday. So it looks like the deadlines will be met.
Now, Tia, this remind us again the original vote tally, because Georgia was one of the states that we've all been waiting to see which way it would go. And apparently, so far, at least, it looks like Joe Biden has won the state of Georgia. This is a state, as you know, that hasn't gone for a Democratic candidate since 1992. What tipped the scales here this time around?
So it's the state, as we mentioned, never got around to really finishing the counting and certifying the numbers before the recount was called. But it looks like Joe Biden is going to win by about 14,000 votes. And that's attributed to Donald Trump losing support, particularly in Atlanta suburbs. And kind of that outer ring of exurbs, if you will, before you get to that solid red rural Georgia. And a lot of older voters, independent voters, college educated voters, and fewer white women were willing to support Donald Trump this time around. That's how Joe Biden was able to win Georgia.
I'm wondering if there's any chance that we could see different results after the recount, or is this pretty much, as you mentioned earlier, just for the sake of transparency and maybe to appease some of what the president mentioned that his concerns are with this election?
Yes, definitely to appease those Trump supporters who have questioned the integrity of the election. Of course, we know because of human error, there could be a shift here or there. Some of the larger counties or some of the counties reported literally one or two difference in ballots, one or two vote difference. So we do not expect a sizable change in the outcome. Again, we're talking about a 14,000 vote margin. It could change, you know, by a handful of votes, you know, 10, 20, 30 is what the trend is looking like, but not anything that could change the outcome of the election in Georgia.
Tia Mitchell is the Washington correspondent with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tia, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
This election, President-elect Joe Biden became the first Democratic presidential candidate to win the state of Arizona in 24 years. And one group who played a major role in flipping the state for Biden was Arizona's Native American population. According to High Country News, counties that included the Navajo Nation, Hopi Tribe, and Tohono O'odham Nation were some of the key areas that helped the president-elect carry the state. And in the swing state of Wisconsin, Native voters also appeared to have been part of turning that state blue. Now, as President-elect Biden prepares to take office, Native organizers and tribal leaders want to make sure he doesn't take their votes for granted.
My name is Leonard Forsman. I'm chairman of the Suquamish Tribe and president of the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians.
Under President Obama, Chairman Forsman was appointed as vice chair of the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. And last month, he endorsed the Biden-Harris ticket along with more than 200 other American Indian leaders. And as Biden begins to assemble his cabinet, Chairman Forsman has a specific request: appoint a Native American official as the next Secretary of the Interior. He and Shannon Holsey, president of the Stockbridge Munsee tribe, made their case in a recent opinion piece for Reuters. When I spoke to the chairman, I asked him to explain why the Department of the Interior is so important to Native communities.
Many of our Indian programs, of course, are housed in the Department of Interior, of course, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and many other agencies that affect Indian country, including the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service. And a lot of this has to do with our trust resources, which are land and water, and cultural resources, sacred places. So it's very important that we have a Secretary of Interior that has a good understanding of Indian country and our values and traditions.
What are some of the main environmental issues that are most important to Indian country and that you think the next Secretary of the Interior should focus on?
Well, in the Pacific Northwest here, we really rely on our treaty resources, as we call them, or our natural resources, wildlife, salmon, traditional plants, clean water, not only for food, but also for medicine and also for our spiritual life and ceremonial life. And we feel that a change in leadership at the Interior will bring us back from the last 4 years of focus on deregulation and profits seem to have come over the importance of protecting habitat and sacred places. And that's been demonstrated in a lot of the activities the administration's engaged in that have ignored tribal needs and priorities in many parts of the West.
One of the people that you suggest could hold the Secretary of Interior role is Representative Deb Holland of New Mexico, who we've had on the show before and who is a citizen of the Laguna Pueblo tribe. Why do you think Representative Holland would be good for the role?
Well, we've known Deb Holland as a congresswoman now for at least one term or more, and she's demonstrated her commitment to Indian country. Obviously, being a member of Laguna Pueblo and very close to their traditions and values, which are very similar to many tribes across the nation, the importance of place and landscape, the cultural landscape, the importance of our traditions, our stories, our way of life, it's all connected strongly to respecting and holding our lands and waters sacred to our survival as Indian people is something that's very important to us. So we really believe that coming from New Mexico, Deb has an understanding of energy policy and also has an understanding of the importance of environmental and natural resource protection. So I think she'll be a good candidate for trying to balance those two things in her leadership of the department.
We've been making a lot about the historic turnout this year for the presidential election and also some of the experiences that people had while trying to cast their vote, mail-in ballots, early voting, long lines, etc. Native American voters have played an important role in this year's election that has potentially been not as talked about, but they did play a big role in battleground states like Arizona. What did that look like this year? What did it look like to get Native voters out to the polls and also to ensure that Joe Biden doesn't take those votes for granted?
Well, the turnout that came through, especially in some of the battleground states, of course, but these votes are great, are important in all the states. But, you know, especially in Arizona, Wisconsin, were a statement of the importance of a leader that shows respect for the presidential office and the sacred duty that leadership has when they're elected by people to hold the tradition of that office important. And I feel that our people understand that our leaders have a great responsibility to build upon their ancestors and build for the future generations. And we just felt like this current administration was not respectful of the protocol of being a leader of our country. And so, among other things that were troubling to us. So I feel that a lot of the turnout was based upon the need for a better and stronger commitment to the numerous priorities that Indian country has. And I think that for the Democratic Party to honor those votes that came out, especially a lot of the new voters, I think is to build upon some of the actions that the Obama administration that Joe Biden was part of and growing those. And that's, you know, getting more land into trust to rebuild our homelands, you know, investing in medical facilities to take care of our medical needs that are guaranteed with under the trust responsibility, you know, investing in sustainable economic development, protecting our natural resources, all those things that he did, including a really strong tribal consultation effort, will be important for the Democratic Party to continue doing as they did in the Obama administration, who I believe is the best president for Indian country that we've had. So in order to keep that vote and for the future, I think that we need to continue to do those things and also let people know about them, because I think a lot of people don't know enough about what the past administration, the Obama administration, did. Settling a lot of lawsuits that had been languishing, like the Cobell and a contract support lawsuit, a lot of things that were very major and influential. I think that we need to make sure that people are aware of those things and the future things that the Biden-Harris administration hopefully has in their transition plan as well.
You mentioned the Obama administration, and you were appointed vice chair of the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation under that administration. How would you assess the relationship between the Department of the Interior and tribal nations under the Obama administration?
Well, one of the things that was very important was the establishment of the White House Council on Native American Affairs. And that was headed up and administered primarily by the Secretary Interior Jewell and also Secretary Salazar. And that council brought the cabinet leaders, cabinet members, into the same room just to discuss interagency-wide tribal issues. So HUD would be there, and OMB, and defense, and all the different agencies would be there, agriculture, to talk about things that they were doing in each of the agencies that all affect Indian country, because, you know, it's just not Interior that affects Indian country. So just to get that started up again, it's barely alive right now, and getting it where the other agencies are engaged as well makes it much more efficient for us to get Indian country policy and priorities introduced to the numerous agencies, you know, especially like HHS and Indian Health, HHS Health and Human Services and Indian Health Service. So that has an opportunity for doing that. And the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation provided a big role of being a facilitator of that meeting. So I hope to look forward to them being involved as well in the future administration.
So on the week of the election, CNN got a lot of criticism for, at one point, putting Native American voters in a category labeled something else when they were talking about voter demographics. What do you think that incident revealed about media coverage of Native voters more broadly?
Well, I think there's just a lack of recognition of the modern present importance of Indian nations in the United States, and there's just a feeling that we're not relevant in some ways, and I don't think that's, you know, 100% pervasive, but I think it still exists on too great of a quantity to be acceptable. And First People have a lot to offer here as individuals and also as members of sovereign nations, and Indian country is so vital to our identity as a nation, and truly authentic way of life connected to our traditional cultural landscapes for thousands of years, and very diverse in itself. And I think it's important to remember that there are members of Indian country that are independents, and some are Republicans as well. And Indian country has been able to have a bipartisan approach to many issues. And the Trump administration did have some Indian policies. I think they were too small a number, but many of them were positive. Some of them were positive in that respect. But we also relied a lot on Congress and members of Congress in a bipartisan manner to work with us on our budget for Indian country. It's so important to our health, safety, and welfare. And feel that the American Indian presence in the voting demographics is very important, and is key to us having leadership that's accountable to, I think, both sides of the arguments that we hear in our electorate today.
And finally, just curious about the state of COVID-19. We know that it has disproportionately affected communities of color, including many Native communities. What has the pandemic looked like among the Suquamish tribe?
Well, here at Suquamish, we've had some small outbreaks, but for the most part, we've been able to isolate and manage the virus for the most part. And that's through a ton of work and commitment from our staff. Our emergency operations center, which is headed by one of our tribal members, and our medical staff, our community nurses, and also our administration and our tribal council. And one of the reasons that I think that we've shown, obviously, is that we've shown such discipline is because of, you know, our history with pandemics. Captain George Vancouver, the British Navy, was our first contact with the outside world in 1792, was the first explorer to come to Puget Sound. And he saw the impacts of smallpox on our people. Some had been survived, had survived smallpox, and had the scars to prove it. And so our people have had long, generational experience with the impacts of communicable diseases. So we've been able to work with the federal government, the state government, and our local government, and follow the rules because we know how important it is to follow the science. And that's been one of the things we hope that the Biden administration will do is really implement those strong restrictions so that we can get through this and get, you know, our economy and our way of life has been, you know, put on hold. We get a lot of the ceremonies and activities that, you know, nourish us culturally and spiritually have been put on hold. So that's been a real challenge for all of us. So we hope to see more progress in national guidance on and leadership on addressing COVID-19.
Chairman Leonard Forsman is the tribal chairman of the Suquamish tribe. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Hasn't given us a whole lot to feel good about. But even in the darkest of times, sometimes it can really help to have a sense of humor. Consider these two pandemic-related jokes. When does season two of 2020 start? Because I do not like season one. Or, I never thought the comment, I wouldn't touch him or her with a 6-foot pole would become national policy, but here we are. My next guest, Joe Firestone, understands the power of humor in dark times. And she's been on a ton of shows, like Broad City and Joe Pera Talks With You, The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. And right before New York City went into lockdown in March, she started teaching a comedy class for seniors in Lower Manhattan. And like many events this year, the class had to move online, where it's continued throughout the pandemic, allowing a group that would otherwise be pretty isolated connect through joke telling. So today we decided to get Joe on the line for some advice on using humor to cope in the coming months. Joe, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And for indulging the cheesy jokes that I just told.
I loved them.
Well, you're teaching seniors right now, and you've also taught comedy to teens in the past. Why is comedy such an important skill for people to have generally?
Well, I guess it's kind of like writing or being able to, you know, drink water. It's just something, it's like a way of coping and living. And, you know, if you're really serious and frustrated all the time, you're going to get really high blood pressure. I'm not a medical professional, but it seems like it helps to have a sense of humor about things, especially when things are very stressful.
In March, when New York City went into lockdown, what was it that made you say in that moment, hey, let's have a comedy class online?
Well, we'd met for 2 or 3 weeks before. And then if you hear 3 weeks worth of jokes out of a group of seniors, you want to hear a few more weeks, you know? And so it was supposed to only meet for like 12 weeks, but we just keep going. We're meeting today. We're going to meet next week. We've been going for about 7 or 8 months now.
And so As the pandemic evolved and the tone and the feeling in New York City became very, very dark, particularly at the peak here in mm-hmm. the spring, how did you maintain a class that was supposed to be about humor?
Well, everybody that came to the class, you know, you have to get up at, Monday at 10 a.m. So you have to be up and ready to start your week with something other than, no offense, like the news, you know. And so I think that the people that came and came regularly wanted to find an outlet and wanted to find a way to make jokes with each other and bring lightness to this horrible situation. So it was kind of like a self-selecting group. So I didn't really have to do much. You know, I just kind of provide the activities and, you know, press start on the Zoom. But really, it's the people that want to be there. That's kind of the driving force.
What kind of prompts do you use to get people started?
Well, for this class in particular, it's a really political class and it's a really raunchy class. So like anything to do with intercourse or the president really gets them going. And so that's kind of any kind of prompts like that, like what would we find in Trump's White House after he leaves, or like, you know, what's the dirtiest Halloween costume you can think of? And then people go on a roll and it's 10 in the morning and they're saying just filthy things.
Now, these are, of course, politically active, raunchy seniors that are telling all types of jokes, Joe. That's got to relieve some tension in the room, but it also, I think, gives a lot of folks a different picture of what we think about when we think about senior elders in this community.
Yeah, I mean, when I first started teaching, I was really hesitant to mention anything political. And then I let something slip and they were all like, we hate him, we hate him, and get so amped and excited. And they're so active, like everyone was telling each other to vote. And it was just this, it's a pretty active group. And like, they're all doing what they can. You know, there's a man who sings out his window. There's a woman who takes pictures. Like, these are pretty active people. I mean, they figured out Zoom, which I still struggle with. You know, when I'm muted, I don't know.
Joe, can anyone tell a joke? Or does it take a special kind of person to have a certain kind of delivery?
Well, I think anybody can be funny. I think if you can get comfortable, you can be funny. I think that's the thing, is it just, maybe not a joke. Maybe you say, you know, maybe you have a funny face when you walk down the street. There's something that you can make funny about yourself. And it's not necessarily a joke writing skill. It's more just like kind of a different approach to life.
Let's talk about how that different approach is playing out now, because, you know, we are in the middle of a devastating pandemic. And, you know, we've been talking here on this show about ways to cope, everything from cooking to asking for help to reaching out to friends, you know, virtually and family virtually. But what role does humor play in a moment like this? I guess, you know, one of the jokes you would say is it too soon? Is it too soon to start making jokes about the pandemic?
Well, we had a discussion about that, and we kind of figured out the line in our class was not to make jokes about the pandemic, but make jokes about the circumstances we're in. So, like, make jokes about being in your house. What's your house look like? What's your apartment feel like at this point? What's in your house at this point? What's a mask feel like? Jokes about masks, jokes about staying safe, socially distancing, things that are not necessarily making fun of the illness itself or the condition a lot of people are in, but more making fun of the circumstances and like that part that we can control.
Joe, what is the importance for you in terms of getting the senior community engaged in laughing? I mean, this is a community and telling jokes and in touch with their comedic parts of themselves, because this is a community that has really borne the brunt of a lot of the coronavirus pandemic, from people who they've lost loved ones or friends. Nursing homes have been ravaged by this. And with the social isolation on top of it, it can't have been easy. So how are your students using this moment to really tap into that sense of humor despite everything that's happening around them? Is it a survival mechanism for them?
I don't know. I think that it's a really hard time. You know, we've lost people in the class, they've lost friends. It's really hard, and some weeks are easier than others.
Some people in the class have gotten the coronavirus and have passed away?
Someone passed away, yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard. And I think that sometimes I talked to one of the gentlemen in the class, Al, and he was having a really hard time because a close friend of his passed, and then he found out and then went to the class. And I think that he wasn't in the mood to laugh, but having 25 other faces looking at you and laughing and making jokes, by being there, you kind of get yourself in the mood to be in a lighter space. And just surrounding yourself with your peers that are trying to make the best of a situation, I think encourages a different outlook. And it's a reminder to try to make jokes. There's so many different styles. Some people do dance comedy. Some people, you know, you could just work on drinking a glass of water pretty funny. You know, maybe you're a riff person. There's all kinds of ways. I wouldn't say everybody's a one-liner person, but there's many ways to be funny, and there's many ways to laugh. And I just think about all the reasons you would laugh in the course of a day. So there's that many ways to be funny.
Joe Firestone is a comedian and a co-star of Cartoon Network's Joe Para Talks With You, which is a big favorite of our director. Joe, thanks so much for joking around with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.